So, this question, in yoga, while doing the movements with the breath, are we following the naturally occurring breath or volitional breath? You are taking deliberate breaths, longer, slower breaths to coordinate with the movements. It's not uncontrolled breathing. I've said this how many hundreds of times. Take a deep, slow breath. Try to take 3 or 4 seconds just to breathe in. You hold the breath in for a couple of seconds while you're holding the posture. You take 3 or 4 seconds to slowly breathe out, going back to the starting point, pausing for a moment or two, and then you repeat it. So that's deliberate, intentional breathing. And the point is to, by doing that, you're developing the ability to breathe more naturally, in slower and deeper breaths, which is more healthy for the body and establishes a more kind of order and rhythm in the nervous system. Although you're not going to breathe that way all the time, but during the yoga exercises, and I mentioned that doing that deep breathing with the movements helps to generate a more dynamic flow of life force, you know, up and down the body. Actually, ideally, those exercises are done in what is called an 8x4 breathing pattern. That means you take 8 seconds just to breathe in, holding the position for 4 seconds, taking 8 seconds to breathe out and return to the starting point, and even pausing 3 or 4 seconds in between. But you have to gradually work up to that ability, because you don't want to struggle and strain at the breathing. So it has to be built up gradually. And the same as what I suggest at the beginning of your meditation period, if you can take these deliberate, slow, deep breaths, learning how to, you know, breathe in, draw the air from the bottom up to the top, taking even up to 6 seconds or even 8 seconds to slowly breathe in, holding the air in for 3 or 4 seconds, and take about 6 or 8 seconds to breathe out, and pausing a couple seconds before the next in breath. If you're able to develop it like that, and can continue that type of breathing for up to 5 or 10 minutes, it puts the mind at the threshold of meditation, because it's forcing you to concentrate to breathe that way. So therefore, it's a good way to concentrate, as well as that deeper rhythmic breathing will help to send waves of relaxing vibrations through the nervous system, and then it kind of puts you in basically in a meditative state. And the longer you can do it, and that impression lasts more in the consciousness. So when you stop doing the controlled breathing, because of that exaggeration of the expanding and contracting, it remains in the background of the consciousness much easier. And so it's something that it lingers there in the mind, so it's easier to have that as a base to be able to, you know, focus on without so much struggling. If you're trying to concentrate the breath here, it's such a light, faint sensation. It's not easy to hold the mind there. It's not very tangible. And anyway, the deep, slow breathing helps to tune in, to stay grounded in the body, from which, especially if you're going to be doing Vipassana meditation and opening into the body, then that kind of breathing is very useful. And it helps to keep the mind more grounded insight. This idea of just, oh, don't control the breath, don't control the breath, just watch the breath. You know, that would be all right if you breathe properly in the first place. But the problem is, Westerners with their neurotic minds, their sedentary lifestyles, their bad postures, the breath has become unnatural. Because of always slouching. And so the breath has become contracted and very short and shallow and very quick because the body needs a certain amount of oxygen to feed the cells. And if you're always slouching around this and the breath can only come in for a half a second, maybe a half a liter of air only or less, and then out, it's got to breathe faster to get enough oxygen. So the average person breathes 15 times a minute, even in relaxation. That's quite fast from the yogic standpoint. And so by deliberately developing deep, slow breathing, you bring the respiration rate down to only 2 or 3 times a minute. And that, because you get enough air in the lungs in one breath, that you normally have to take 5 or 6 breaths to get the same amount of oxygen into the lungs. So there's much more distraction and agitation in the system with the breath going in and out so quickly. So the idea in yoga, you develop the deep, slow breathing, those slow rhythmic movements has a much more relaxing and soothing effect than this erratic, short, shallow type of breathing. So anyway, that's just sort of some of the physiology behind this kind of, you know, pranayama, and why it's been part of the yogic system is a precursor or prelude to meditation. Yogis practice that kind of deep, slow breathing because it helps put them into that meditative state. But once you actually get into the meditation, you don't deliberately do the deep breathing, because to go deeper into meditation, trying to control the breath would be a distraction. But it's not a distraction in the beginning. It can be a help. But all this emphasis, you know, they tell beginners, oh, don't control the breath, don't control the breath. I don't think that's helpful. Because you have to learn how to breathe first before you not to control the breath. So we're retraining the breath to breathe in a more natural, healthy way, which is going to be overall good for everything. So anyway, that's just my take on it and why I emphasize that, because very few, if none, of Buddhist teachers ever talk about, you know, developing this kind of breathing. Anyway, it's true that in the deeper parts of the meditation, you don't want to control the breath. But by doing it at the beginning and in between, like when you're falling asleep or too much thoughts, you come back and do that. For even just taking like 2 or 3 deep, slow breaths can really just bring the mind right back into the present moment and calm things down. And then you let it go, and then you continue for a while, and you can come back to it whenever the need is there. So what are the differences and benefits of prayer, chanting, and meditation? Prayer, of course, is a way of kind of reflecting on whatever sort of beliefs you have, but in Buddhism we don't really pray. It may look like people are praying, but it's not praying in the sense of other religions might pray to a god asking for favors or so on. But in some of the chants and in the devotional book that you see, even though it may look like we're asking the Buddha for forgiveness, but we're not really praying to the Buddha, we're addressing our own unconscious mind. The Buddha within, that means the wisdom within our own mind. May the Buddha forgive me, that means because of my negligence, forgive whatever I've done from body, speech, or mind. We're talking to our own unconditioned mind. We're not thinking there's a Buddha out there that's going to forgive us or to grant any other favors. It's all sort of symbolic, and we're addressing that inner wisdom that we have inside of ourself, giving us the strength, the patience, mindfulness, wisdom, and so on. We're talking to our own deeper mind, not some external deity or Buddha. So, you know, at least in the Theravada tradition, praying to somebody outside of yourself is not really a part of what we're doing in the chanting. And chanting is a way to concentrate the mind, and the chants are about aspects of Dhamma. So you're chanting qualities of the Buddha, you're thinking about them. Qualities of the Dhamma, it can help to give you inspiration, and so on. So there are tools and methods that we use to initially withdraw the mind from its external involvement, focus inside, and once the chanting and so on is over, then we get into the more silent meditation. The benefits of meditation, that should be obvious. Benefits of meditation are learning how to control your thoughts, keep the mind more centered, and of course eventually developing insight and wisdom. You spoke of strong karmic connection in families. My family of 10 people is a great deal of comparison, competition, criticism, and unkindness. Often I find it easiest to keep a distance from them, so to speak, so they won't agitate my mind so much. In the Dhamma or Buddhism, encourage attempting to be a healing presence in this karmic relationship, or is loving detachment a reasonable alternative? A lot of people might find themselves in these kind of situations, family situations. Yeah, there is a lot of karma in the family connections, as we have already mentioned. But that doesn't mean that you're bound to the family. But of course, the parents, it's our duty to try to be kind to the parents, because for 20 years they sacrificed a lot to raise us up and so on. And so even though they might not be good parents, at least we try not to not like them or and so on, and to develop metta for them. But you don't have to act as a peacemaker in the family and try to, get everyone to behave and so on. There's certain people you're not going to get along with, and there's some karma there. But even though you want to reproach with them or be friends with them, maybe they're, just very hard, and they have anger toward you, and they for whatever reasons. And you can't change people. We can try to do what we can to be friendly to our family and so on, and keep doors of communication open. But with certain individuals in the family, if it's not possible, we shouldn't overstretch ourselves so that we cause ourselves more tension and worry about it. And we can purify our thoughts about them But if they don't want to accept it, then it doesn't mean you have to keep those relationships. I mean, in the whole presence of samsara, we've been related to, so many different people. And maybe the people in the present family, maybe for a few lifetimes or so, you might have been associated. It doesn't mean you have to keep that association. But it should mean that you don't have harbor anger and hate or resentment toward them, even whatever they might do to you, whatever they feel about you. If you can't change them, at least not to harbor ill will towards them, send them metta, compassion. They have their own karma to work out. And as long as you don't have ill feelings to them, then probably in the next lives, you may go your separate ways. Your mind will be attracted to some other situations and so on. But if there's mutual hatred amongst the people, then that's what will attract you back together again to work all that kind of stuff out. That's why it's paramount in our training, in the Dhamma training, to practice forgiveness, not harbor resentment, ill will, even to our enemies, to cultivate metta. So we, even if the others still hate us, they still try to maintain an open, friendly mind. But it doesn't mean you have to love them. It means at least you don't have hateful thoughts to them. You don't go half around loving everybody. It's that you don't, not in a sexual way, but being this idea of love, the Western idea of love. It's just that we don't want to hate them, and we try to have at least, wish people well. Because if they're free from greed, hatred, and delusion, then maybe they won't do the kind of things to us that, disturb us. But everyone's sick, right? They're sick with their own greed, hatred, and delusion. And because everyone has their own karmic history they have to work with. And each lifetime is like a school or a classroom. And if you don't learn your lessons about selflessness, about loving kindness, about generosity, about patience, and so many good qualities, if you fail those lessons, that's what you have to come back again to, pass the test, so to speak, the challenges that life brings you. If you get defeated by it, then you're going to have to come back and work it out again. Could you please elaborate on the various stages of enlightenment? How long does it take a day, a person practicing 30 minutes of vipassana, to reach the first stage? No. How long would it take a monk? What are the achievements of each stage? Anyway, you could write a whole book on that. So I don't have time to go into all that. There's books written on that you can read. I wouldn't worry so much about the stages of enlightenment. I would just worry about trying to gain the more practical, mundane benefits of the meditation, cultivating gradually concentration, mindfulness, wisdom, learning how to overcome your negative mental states. And at the time when you're ready, that the spiritual faculties are cultivated, and it's completely different for every single person. One person could attain the first stage of enlightenment, just by listening to a Dhamma talk. Another person might have to listen to thousands of Dhamma talks and spend thousands of hours meditating, and even then be lucky to reach the first stage. This is all the difference between people. If you read in the Buddhist text, 500 people listening to one discourse of the Buddha attained enlightenment. While one man at Shravasti, the Buddha lived in a place, Shravasti, where he delivered many sermons, and he He lived there for 25 rainy seasons. And there was a farmer who lived behind the monastery. He butchered pigs. He never once came to listen to a Dhamma talk. People could hear the squeals of pigs being slaughtered. He never once came to a Dhamma talk, while other thousands and thousands of people came and listened, attained enlightenment. This one person didn't have it. You know? He didn't have the spiritual qualities to be interested in Dhamma, even though he was living right next to the Buddha. So like that, there are so many people at different stages of life. And so there's no any rules about how long it's going to take stages. A person can attain the first stage of enlightenment, and it might take 7 lifetimes before they reach enlightenment. Another person could attain the first stage of enlightenment today and reach the second stage tomorrow, and full enlightenment the next day, or all at once even. It depends on the maturity of your spiritual faculties. That means faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. And how much work have you already done in the past lives as to how quick you're going to get it in this life. But 30 minutes of Vipassana each day, come on, give me 45. Okay. But no guarantees. Do animals, but more specifically bugs, have karma? If no, then why is the animal bug on the samsara wheel of existence? If yes, then you talked about a cockroach drowning. Possibly they're living out their karmic existence. Anyway, you know, the idea of karma and rebirth is so, you know, very complex and profound. But accordingly, I mean, even bugs, the smallest insects, they're considered living beings. That means sentient beings. That means they can feel things and they have at least some kind of rudimentary awareness. You know, some are very intelligent. Look at a small little ant. Tiny, tiny little ant. You know, they're very intelligent. You know, ant colonies. I mean, you know, wow. You see them walking along in order. And there's a lot of intelligence in something that small as an ant. And so anything that's conscious has the possibility for evolution. But it may take, you know, a long, long time. But, you know, we don't have the right to deprive any living being of life, because they also want happiness, like anybody else. Mosquito is just trying to live like you are, sucking your blood. That's the only way he knows. Or a bed bug, you know, getting warm in your bed. And then, you know, he needs food also. A lot of bugs eating our dead skin and bacteria and microorganisms, worms living in our stomach. This body is just food for a lot of animals too. They're all just trying to be happy. Just as we eat food, we eat animal bodies, right? Meat eaters. So why can't animals and insects eat our body? I have a PhD. That can't happen. You see, we have all this arrogance. So anyway... You know, as far as do animals have karma and so on. You see, the problem is once you get born as an animal, the brain capacity and the intelligence of an animal is very, very limited, just to their survival, basically. And they don't have the evolution to really think about right and wrong. And so they remain trapped in just whatever natural instinct and habits that they have, and there's very little possibility for developing wisdom and evolving. So this is a very interesting simile the Buddha gave. The simile of the blind turtle. Let's say you got a blind turtle. Maybe one blind eye. Anyway, he's swimming around in the ocean. And he comes up to breathe, pokes his head up to breathe air once in 100 years. Maybe 100 years is too much. Once a year. Anyway, and just at that time that he comes up, there happened to be a rubber ring or something floating on the ocean, being blown from the Atlantic to the Pacific, to the North Sea, to the Mediterranean. And just at that time when the turtle pokes his head up to get a breath, that ring is right on that spot and pokes his head up through the ring. Now, mathematically speaking, that's a pretty slim chance, right? Any mathematicians here? Crunch some numbers. Okay, so it's harder than that for an animal to get a human birth. Especially if you've lost it as a human being and been reborn from the human realm to an animal realm, to get it back again is harder for that than that turtle popping his head up through the hole in the ring, because of the difficulty of animals being able to practice the Dhamma and evolve their minds. Except in the case of pets. Now, this is the case where Western pets like dogs and cats, they get very familiar with human beings and they don't have to go out and fight. You give them a nice can of Friskies, and they don't have to go out and fight the other dogs and rummage through trash cans, and they stay in the human house. They bring you their slippers, or they bring you your slippers, and curl up on your bed, sleep in your bed. So they get very familiar with human beings, and they're not doing a lot of bad things like getting into fights and animal things. So they have the best opportunity to get a human birth because they're so familiar with that. Everything from the human realm is very familiar to them. And so it's very possible that pets like that could reach up, get a slot in the human realm. But it would probably be a slot that's, not that good of a human existence, but, barely making it in, but they can work their way up gradually. Anyway, that's all theoretical, but that's just an idea of how that kind of evolution works. But the human realm is said to be the best realm for practicing the Dhamma, because our brains and nervous system are in the most evolved state. We have the ability to think about right and wrong. We have and the means to hear the Dhamma, read the Dhamma, find out about Dhamma, and talk with people and learn spiritual things, which is very difficult or impossible in the animal world. And also in the other worlds too, the hungry ghosts, and even in the heaven realms, there's too much pleasure. People are enjoying the bliss and pleasures of heavens, they're not interested in Dhamma so much. Although there are some, of course. There are some spiritualized beings born in the Deva realms, and they can make progress there too, but it's probably limited. So anyway, I'm just saying that the human realm is considered to be the best realm for learning the Dhamma, practicing the Dhamma, and attaining the stages of liberation. That's why the imperative is not to lose it. Because if you live like an animal in this life, good chances are you get an animal body in the next life. I have killed many ants in the past while cleaning kitchen. Sometimes it's unavoidable. How bad is this? Consider precept one. Do you have any suggestion? Don't kill any more, and then don't worry about it. You know, they actually, I mean, you may think this is sounds unfair or something like that, but according to law of karma, killing a human being is much more karmically heavy than killing an animal. And the bigger the animal, the more heavy the karma. So the smaller the animal, like say killing ants or cockroaches, because their consciousness isn't that developed, there may be less sort of a karmic effect of that. And whether you believe in that or not, but that's usually the kind of guidelines. So even though we don't want to purposely kill, there may be times, especially before you studied Dhamma, and I also used to kill things. But one time in my own experience, the last time I ever deliberately killed something was I speared a fish, you know, when I was snorkeling, you know, back when I was a layperson. And I brought the fish out and I saw it at the end and I got sick. I said, that's it, I'm never going to do that again. Just seeing that spear through the fish, it just like really turned my stomach. I was disgusted. And I pulled it off and see if it would swim free, but you know, I think it died. And I swore off that time that I would not kill anything more. Although I sometimes accidentally, I may have also, you know, not knowing. We walk on ants, we're insects in the forest, but in the karma, it's deliberate action. So if you unintentionally kill something, even though you know you might feel bad about it, the consequence is probably negligible in terms of the karmic effects of that. Many traditions speak a lot about finding God. Is there no God in Buddhism? Is Buddha a God? No, Buddha is not a God. And by the way, there are gods within the Buddhist cosmology, but they're not creator gods as such. Not the way that, let's say, a Christian or a Muslim or somebody would have the idea of a creator God. There are heaven realms where they're, you know, I mean, when we say God, I mean, it's a Western term, right? What does it mean? Usually in Western terminology, God means only one thing, some creator. But within Buddhist cosmology, there's many realms where devas and Brahma, they are called gods, but it's not in the same way. They're just celestial beings. They're beings that live in these celestial places and so on have very, very long lifetimes. You're experiencing, you know, bliss, and they have certain powers, but they're also impermanent. And you're born there because of certain types of karma, and you can fall out of that and be born into hell even, depending on what kind of karma got you reborn in places. So Buddha is not a god. He's an enlightened person. See, that's the difference. In Christianity, you can never be equal to God. You can never even be equal to Jesus if you're following the so-called traditional dogma. We're always a poor little sinner. But in Buddhism, that's not the case. We may have done sins, but we can change ourselves. And by using the power, the inherent power that we have within us, we can save ourselves. Although we depend on the Buddha as a teacher and the Sangha to help to get inspiration and some guidance until we get our feet grounded in the practice. But then after that, you don't need any external kind of support once you, you know, learn the Dhamma and can practice. Then, you know, but of course, having contact with spiritual friends and, you know, like like a mentor, a teacher, that you can always, you know, come for encouragement, advice, and things, and if you're still, you know, weak in some respects, that's considered very helpful. That's why the refuge in the Sangha is important. But not, and you know, so in Buddhist religion, they don't pray to gods like they might pray in other religions, as I had already mentioned. Although some Buddhists may do it because there's some contamination of Hinduism in Buddhism in some certain countries. And so you might find some of that, but it's not really to do with Buddhism. It's just due to cultural intermix and confusion that people have. And the people, they need some, you know, they're so used to praying for favors, and they're praying for this god for this favor and this god for that favor. But in Buddhism, they don't encourage that. The Buddha was called the teacher of gods and men. Gods come to the Buddha to learn. And devas, in some places, devas are, you know, disembodied beings. You can't see them because they have bodies of fine, like light waves that we can't see with our human eye. But clairvoyants can see them. Actually, I have a photo, a digital photo of a deva. But anyway, that's another story. and you know, there may well be devas in this room listening to Dhamma. Maybe not my Dhamma, but very famous monks in Thailand, well-known Dhamma teachers and arahants, the devas who have reached stages of the stream entry or once returning and so on, they want to learn the Dhamma. There's many stories. There's a story of the Buddha was giving a lecture. There was a lot of lay people crowded in or standing up. And the Buddha said, sit down, sit down. And then they asked him, why are you telling us to sit down? He said, you're blocking the view of the devas. And they looked and they couldn't see anything. But the Buddha, with his clairvoyant vision, could notice there were hundreds of devas there, you know, with the palms respectively folded, you know, wanting to listen to the Dhamma. But you see, most skeptical Westerners would poo-poo that sort of thing. But, you know, because, you know, Western material science, if you can't put it in a test tube, it doesn't exist. If you can't measure with the, you know, electronic microwave system or whatever, gadgets, then it doesn't exist. But that's the limitations of modern science. If our attachments lead us to suffering, should I then never become involved in a romantic relationship? Is that just a social construct I should avoid in order to find happiness? You might not like my answer. They're not. Don't ask a monk that, because they'll say no. I mean, why do people want to be involved in a romantic relationship? This is a human invention. And sex is for procreation. It was made for that, right? Nature made it to reproduce human beings. But most people have sex not for procreation. Maybe they did once or twice, but after that, no. But for craving, or so-called love relationship. But, you know, it's usually based on lust and desire, and a lot of those relationships, as you well know, don't last. So you always have to ask yourself, why do I want a romantic relationship? Is there something lacking in me that I need somebody else? People feel lonely, so they get attracted to have a mate, somebody they can talk to, have some romantic relationship. But I think this is overblown, especially in the human society, in the Western society, it's way overblown. You don't find that kind of romantic relationship so much in the Eastern societies. They have arranged marriages in India and other places. So like a business deal. And sure, the people might, you know, procreate and have some, but it's not so complex and involved as it is in the, I mean, now it is, because even the Eastern countries are getting westernized, but before it wasn't like that. So anyway, anytime you get involved with somebody, you're entering their karma, and you're going to have to deal with it. But if you can live alone and be quite happy, be contented, fulfilled, you can do whatever you do to help others, be kind to others, and, you know, we fill ourselves with the Dhamma. When you fill yourself with the Dhamma, that's the relationship. And it's much more fulfilling in most cases. Because the Dhamma doesn't let you down. You might let the Dhamma down, but the Dhamma won't let you down. The Dhamma is like an umbrella. It protects you. But you have to take care of the Dhamma. If you neglect the Dhamma, and your moths and ants eat holes in the umbrella and you go out, then you're going to get wet. But whoever takes care of the Dhamma will protect you. But it has to be undertaken in the right, you know, in the right spirit and so on. That we use the Dhamma as a raft to cross the ocean of samsara. We don't use the Dhamma just to get name, fame, publicity, become a great Dhamma speaker, or to make money, make a business deal out of it, and or use it to defeat others in Dhamma dialogue and so on. I mean, having a romantic relationship may be all right for lay people, but you know, you have to understand that those relationships are impermanent. And is the suffering involved in a relationship worth the effort? And whatever happiness, if you put it on a scale of happiness and suffering in any type of relationship, are you more happy and suffering maybe just a little bit, or suffering more and happiness may just be a little bit. And you yourself have to make that decision and proceed from there. But it's because loneliness, people go back into relationship after relationship. You know, many people have been married 3 or 4 times. The next one will be the perfect one. The next one will be my soulmate. Some people might find that, but probably, you know, not the majority. So it's, having, you know, a relationship, if it breaks up, before jumping into another one, you ask yourself, why do I need another? Why can't I just be single, have enough time? I can have friends, but what's the need of romantic relationship? You can have many, many types of friends. So this is, you know, something that, you know, you should always kind of, before you get involved in something, carefully consider. That's really the criterion. Before you do that becoming, carefully consider. What are the consequences going to be? What are going to be the advantages or disadvantages? Am I prepared for that? Today, when discussing becoming, all but one example you gave was a bodily action. Turning on the fan, stealing, lying, etc. However, isn't most becoming a mental rather than a bodily action? Well, the mind is behind all of our bodily actions. All becoming is the mind, that's true. You're right. Becoming is mental. But the karma, the painful results, is usually with the bodily action. But the mind is causing the body to tell the lie, to steal, to go molest somebody, or do any other negative thing. The mind is doing that. So the mind definitely is in the becoming. But it manifests as a physical action that reverberates in the physical realm and produces its effects back to us to affect us both physically and mentally. So yes, the becoming is physical. The becoming is mental. All those paticca-samuppadas are mental events. But they manifest as the actions of speech and body actions, which produce the karmic, heavy karmic results. But you produce karma just by thinking too. If I'm sitting here and I'm thinking hatred towards you, and or if I'm thinking lustful thoughts, that is also a kind of becoming, because you're generating more greed, more lust, more hatred through the mind, which is eventually going to cause you to take action upon it later. Is that those phrases, sow a thought, reap an action. If you think about something only once, maybe you'll never take action on it. But if you think about it again, and then again, if you think about it enough, then finally you say, I'm going to do that. And then you create the action. And if the action turns out to have some benefit for you, then you say, I think I'll do that again. And so that action then becomes a habit. And then if you continue with that habit, then it's going to become your character. You're going to be defined by that. In your own mind as well as from others. And then eventually you're going to get caught. The hammer is going to come down hard. Either with getting put in prison, getting killed by somebody else, or just going insane, or any number of things. How does one use the pronoun I without reinforcing its existence? By understanding what the I is. And it's a term of conventional usage. When I was a young monk, I got real gung-ho, and so I started saying, Rahula would like to go here and there. Can Rahula do this? People were looking at me like, and so if you start talking about yourself in the third person, you're going to raise a lot of curious sort of stares. But the Buddha, he said, the Tathagata does this, the Tathagata does that. But sometimes he did also use the term I. But we have to understand, we use it in conventional usage. We have to conform to the conventions of society, because if we don't, we'll cause confusion and so on. But we have to know the limits of that conventional language and use it, but not be deluded by it. So just for the sake of communication and so on, whatever particular culture we have to be in and language we're using, we have to basically use the norms of that in order to communicate effectively. But we also have to know the limitations of the language and not to be deluded by it. What's wrong with drinking a glass of wine or smoking a joint? Well, I drank and smoked my share, that's for sure, you know, before I became a monk, for those who read my book. But, you know, when we take the precept of abstaining from intoxicating the mind, it's because most people don't know how to stop with just one glass of wine or one joint. Let's say one beer that may not cause you to do anything unskillful. But the problem is most people, they get a little buzz and then they want to get a more buzz. And so, just an example, you know, you're at a party and somebody says, come on, have one beer. And I'd rather, no, one beer is not going to matter. So, okay, to be friendly, you know, you drink a beer. I'll have another one. Drink a second beer. No, give me a third one. And before you know it, you're taking off your clothes and peeing all over the table, pinching butts. Right? Have you seen that before? Have you done it yourself? Okay, that is the danger. Or get in your car and drive and then kill somebody. In the same way with taking any other kind of drugs, it becomes, you know, the pleasant high that you get out, we want to do it more, we want to do it more. And then eventually it's going to cause some problems. Because the mind is always seeking more craving, more pleasurable feeling. And the more it helps you to forget about your problems, then we want to indulge in it more and more, and then eventually it's going to come down hard. So that's why the precept is abstain from it. Be content with meditation. Why do you want to indulge in those things? Get high from meditation, and so on. And the peer pressure that people have. And here's a new phenomenon now. People say, well, if I don't drink, no one will invite me to party. But now everybody wants a designated driver, right? So now Buddhists are getting invited to parties in order to drive the drunk people home. So you get invited to more parties when people know you're a teetotaler. Oh, let's invite so-and-so. Yeah, they're a Buddhist. And drive us home. So you make more friends. Well, maybe not. Are awareness and mindfulness the same? Sati. Kind of yes, and kind of there could be a difference also. The same with when I say the difference between consciousness and awareness. But these are just definitions of the way that I like to see them that makes sense for my own sort of understanding. Is that, you know, mindfulness, there's many aspects to mindfulness. But to be right mindfulness, there has to be wisdom accompanying it. I mean, you can be just ordinary mindful, but you might not be practicing sammasati. Mindfulness just means awareness. You say, okay, I'm mindful. I'm picking this up. But sammasati has the clear comprehension along with it that sees impermanence of the action and knows the nature of that kind of movement. And seeing the arising and vanishing of that particular movement. And being careful also not to do the negative things. If you're, you know, mindfully killing a mosquito, that's BS. That's not right mindfulness. Right mindfulness wouldn't break the precepts. It's wrong mindfulness that'll break the precepts. So people think they can go to a party and mindfully drink, mindfully do this, mindfully do that. The word's very vogue these days, but it's used in very superficial ways, at least according to the Dhamma, you know, the way that we practice. So again, that's what I mentioned today. There's ordinary view and there's right view. Or there's a wrong view and right view. Or there's ordinary mindfulness is in contrast with right mindfulness. There's ordinary concentration as opposed to contrast to right concentration. Because according to the Buddha's definition of even a right concentration, it has to be supported by the Eightfold Path. That means there has to be right mindfulness behind the concentration and right effort. And also right view. So that's a distinction a lot of people overlook. Oh, we just practice concentration. Okay, it is concentration. Maybe it's mindfulness, but it's only ordinary. It's not samma. It's not the Buddha's mindfulness. It's not the Buddha's concentration. So, you know, that's a kind of a difference. So anyway, so anyway, we're practicing mindfulness. You know, you're also aware. I mean, you are aware. So for all intents and purposes, but you can be aware of awareness. Just means, okay, I hear a sound. But that might not have wisdom along with it. Whereas you're mindful of a sound. You know what the sound is. You know it's a sound vibration. Where in just awareness, there isn't that kind of understanding of it. So that would be a kind of a difference between awareness and mindfulness. And in mindfulness, you're doing things deliberately, normally. It means you're mindful of what you know what you're doing. Mindfulness means you know what you're doing. A lot of people know that they're lifting the arm, but that's not really mindfulness. To be mindful that you're lifting the arm, you're aware of every intention that's behind the movement, that's driving the muscles to cause the arm to lift up, lift, 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 lift. Open, touch, rub. That's really, right mindfulness. But, you know, just going up like this, scratch your head. You know, you might be aware that you're doing that, but that's not mindfulness. So that would be the difference. And mindfulness is also a very sharp clarity of attention, a very bright clarity of attention. It can be, you know, almost be like a flashbulb going off in the mind when something arises. There's very bright attention to it. So there's degrees of the mindfulness as well. And the distinction I make between consciousness and awareness is that consciousness usually has the ego with it, the sense of I am conscious. I am hearing, I am seeing, smelling, tasting, touching, thinking. Where awareness is a more of an expansive openness in which that sense of the I is very kind of weak. There's more of a, you know, things just coming and going, but consciousness is normally, you know, focusing on things. Where awareness is more of an expansive thing. And things are coming and going, but there isn't so much kind of a grasping and reaction. At least when I use the terms, I kind of try to use them in that way. To develop expanded awareness, I might use that term, you know, let the awareness expand, you know. Instead of the awareness, you know, looking out the eyeballs and, you know, contracted as an ego consciousness. It's a contracted state. But when that sense of self and I weakens and starts to dissolve, then the awareness becomes very, very expansive, and you can notice many, many hundreds and thousands of things actually just arising and vanishing without any conflict, without any type of friction, very clearly. The bottomless pit here. How many people want to listen to more questions or want to meditate?
Questions.
Questions. Your question, right? I was dismayed that you seemed to equate disconnecting someone from artificial means to sustain life with assisted suicide or violation of the first precept. Recognizing that one's body cannot sustain itself and asking to be released from unnatural means, or asking one's medical representative to make the decision. Actually, yeah, after I, later on I reflected, because I'm not that familiar with the term assisted suicide. And it's actually somebody who's not on life support, who just wants to end their life. Okay, so I wasn't, when I answered the question, I probably didn't address that clearly because I guess I was interpreting assisted suicide to mean like, euthanasia or something, or pulling the plug on something. So I'm sorry if I had misunderstood your, that question in that sense. So anyway, the assisted suicide, at least, from a Buddhist point of view, that's something a Buddhist probably shouldn't let the person do their own. If somebody wants to commit suicide, let them do it on their own. They shouldn't ask somebody else to do it for them. At least not a Buddhist, somebody who doesn't want to get involved in that, because there could be some karmic connection. Now, if somebody wants to do it, that's their own business. But they shouldn't involve somebody else to get involved in their karma, because it involves getting somebody involved in their karma. Now, in terms of somebody on life support, like I said, you know, my mother, she wrote it in her will, if she ever goes on life support, that she wants to pull the plug. And I would completely, honor that thing, although I wouldn't tell the doctor to do it necessarily, as I told you. My brother and sister would probably do that, but anyway, I recognize that there's difference now between assisted suicide and then just taking people off of life support. But it becomes tricky because some people on life support have actually come back to functioning levels and so on. If somebody would have pulled the plug, then that might have terminated the life. There's even a guy on the news last month who died for 45 minutes. Died in a hospital. The doctor pronounced him dead, going to tell the relatives about to wheel his body out to the morgue, and then he woke up. Somebody on life support, even though it might look like all their functions are dead, you don't know about the consciousness. And there have been cases of people in comas. I read a report. Somebody was in a coma for 45 years and finally woke up out of it. For 45 years in a coma. Although he didn't live very long, but nevertheless he did woke up and was conscious for a short period of time. And so, there's lots of mysteries about consciousness and the mind that we don't know. And we shouldn't just believe everything that Western science wants us to believe in terms of who's dead, who's not, who's conscious, who's not, and so on, because, you know, scientific instruments can't necessarily register the very subtle levels of consciousness and awareness. So, you know, it's a kind of a tricky thing. But again, you know, you've got to live with your own decisions. What you decide, in those kind of cases, probably the effects, karmic effects, would be very minimal, because for one thing, you don't have hatred behind it, and any gross ulterior motives probably. It's out of compassion you might do those things, so maybe the consequences may be negligible. But that's, you know, up to you decide, and it's up to each person to decide. The precepts are guidelines. It said, well, you know, in terms of karma and suffering, these are the general guidelines. And you either follow them or you don't. That's up to you. No one's forcing you to do it. And it just depends on each person. And if you're willing to take the responsibility of any karmic consequences of anything you do, then that's up to you. That's your business. But don't blame anybody else if something goes wrong, or if there's some effects of that. Because that Dr. Kevorkian, you know, he got put in jail because, you know, out of compassion he was helping people die, right? But the law, you know, put him in jail for doing that. He had compassionate grounds for doing that, I guess. But, you know, we live in a society with certain laws, and if you transgress those, then you're subject to the laws of that they come, whether you believe in it or not. I think we'll stop there and don't write any more questions. Or one question per person. I think somebody's writing 4 or 5 questions, so it fills up the box. Again, just try to bring your attention back to the body. You can stand up to stretch your legs. 3 minutes.